Estergom. First, Coton, the ground steward and the curate. Merrick sat hunched over in the driver's seat of the cart, the winds blowing eastward across the Adany Plains, whipping the fur-lined cloak wrapped around him. Long, dark hair flowed out beneath a great fur hat, and icicles dangled from his thick beard and moustache. The act was futile. Merrick was an enormous man, and even bent over, he could not hide his body from the biting winds. It reached through every crevice of his cloak and the gambeson he wore beneath. He was an old soldier, though, and he bore this discomfort in silence. Two draft horses pulled the cart, one chestnut, the other black. Their long manes and tails whipped about, lifted by the blowing winds. They did their task with heads bent, their thoughts focused on a warm barn filled with late summer hay. Merrick was a good caretaker. The horses were healthy, well-fed, and could tolerate cold temperatures better than their master. They were close to a warm barn, if not their own. Could the horses have understood, Merrick would have told them to give them hope. He had been travelling for 4 moons, and by his measure, their destination, the orphanage of Malmok, was less than 1 or 2 cold leagues away. He had departed for the orphanage from the trade city of Adany. The day he left, the weather had been comfortable, as much as winter on the plains could be. The travel, not as much. Old roads in an old cart. Every bump and jolt, over rock or through puddle, travelled upward through the cart's frame and seemingly right into Merrick's ass, up his spine, finally resting in his neck. The old soldier endured this as well. On the third day, the northwest winds, which the farmers called the Latia, came flowing over the Estergom range, the peaks of which could be seen far off in the distance, rising above the northern edge of the great Koza forest. In the spring, the winds shifted and came from the south, bringing the warm desert air northward. The farmers called those the Lanya. At first, the Latia was just a breeze, enough to slightly bounce the brown tips of the tall grass that covered the plains. Eventually it gained strength, sending small gusts flowing over the endless fields. By the end of the third day, the gusts had increased tenfold and raced across the open plains like a herd of horses. They rolled over the hillocks and bent the tops of the tall grass that poked up from the deep snow, making it appear that the blades were all supplicants worshipping some unseen god. Snow would be lifted and whipped across the plains, creating huge drifts. These sometimes blocked the road, and Merrick would spend an hour or two clearing a path for the cart. The day droned on, the scenery repeated, and the cold and howling wind never ceased. Each night, he could see the light from one of the towers at Malmok getting closer. Its beam shining out over the plains like a lighthouse near the ocean. Distance was hard to determine in the vast open space, and Merrick feared he would need to spend another night under the stars. He began to look for a hollow to bed the horses. As the sun began to sink and the gloaming settled in, the old soldier's instincts flared. Merrick sat up, blinking against the storm, staring eastward across the plains. The wind howled, but something in it sounded different, a tone beneath the storm, a call. He listened harder, but the Latia's gusts were deafening, swallowing all else. A dark shape loomed beyond the snowfall, shifting through the mist. A wolf? No, too large. It stood alone, a hulking black figure against the swing through the drifts. The storm surged, a sudden gust hammering into the cart, making the horses shift uneasily. Snow exploded into the air, blinding, impenetrable. Merrick flinched, one hand gripping the seat for balance, the other steadying the reins. He cursed under his breath. When the snow settled, the shape was gone. Merrick watched the spot for a long moment, breath misting in the cold, the hunger, the sleepless nights, the ache in his bones. Perhaps he was seeing things. He pulled his cloak tighter and hunched back down. There was no wolf, no howl, just the wind. He rode on, scanning the fields for a place to camp. Shortly, he came across a suitable hollow just off the road. It was deep enough to offer some protection from the wind, but not steep enough to get himself stuck if it snowed that night. As he gazed at it, contemplating if he should abandon any more travel for the day, the road began to incline. Merrick let a relieved smile cross his face. They were close. He looked up from beneath the tangle of hair and the brim of his fur cap and squinted. Off in the distance, between drifting snow, he could just see the hillock that Malmok sat upon, a relative mountain in this sea of low hills and flat plains. He lightly snapped the reins, and the two horses, perhaps sensing his improved spirits, put more effort into their steps. The sun had slipped below the horizon, and the world had turned a dark grey as it settled in for nightfall. In the near distance, the round towers at each end of Malmok stood out in stark contrast to the soft, rolling landscape, hard, geometric shapes against a backdrop of curves and waves. The walls ran at angles from each side of the towers to meet at a central point. If one could fly like a hawk and pass overhead, Malmok would appear to have been built in the shape of a diamond. Merrick hunched his body down, lowered his head, and settled in for the final part of the journey. The orphanage was built on top of the only hillock for leagues on the Great Plain, and when the Latia sped down from the distant mountains and the tall grass bent to its will, the towers stood in their pride, an affront to the wind's demand for subjugation. Merrick knew the history of these towers, former grist mills for the local farmers. Built with the more expensive stone from quarries beyond Estergom, the hidden message of wealth and power transparent for those who knew such things. As he passed under the shadow of the nearer tower, Merrick looked up at the weathered stone. He wondered if the local farmers had viewed these monuments with pride or fear in their time. When the mills had been the economic centre for all grain bound for the markets where Adany now stood. The cart arrived at the base of the hillock. The calf steepened and wound around the orphanage. The horses now put more effort into their task. As the team and cart lumbered up the path, Merrick noted a graveyard set off somewhat in the plains. He turned his gaze away from the graves and to the orphanage walls. Made of the darker, almost black stone from the quarries in the Estergom range, they were softer than the brownstone from afar. Though the walls were not as old as the towers, they were still old, hewn in the early days of the Estergom Banate. Of lesser quality and built without the skill of the ancient stonemasons, they were in dire need of point work. Many were pitted, and in some places, missing chunks, worn down by wind and rain, cold and heat. The cart rumbled along until it reached the gate, which had a pair of elm doors hanging on iron hinges with round iron handles. On the right side of the doors, a bell, also made of iron, was attached to the wall. He stopped the horses just short of the gate, climbed off the cart, and walked up to the bell. He pulled the chain, rang it thrice, and stood back to wait. After what he considered a reasonable amount of time had passed, and no one answered, he rang the bell again, pulling harder on the chain. The bell's peals had not finished when a sliding window in the middle of the door flew open, and a young man with a pimply face, red from the cold, looked through, saying, "Hold on now, show some patience." The man was dressed in the black robes and cowl of a penury, a novice cleric in the Holman religious order. His eyes widened when he saw the giant of a man standing in front of the gate, but narrowed when he asked, "What are you selling?" Merrick looked surprised and said, "I am selling nothing. Well, we don't want to buy nothing, sneered the cleric, pleased with how clever he had just been, and he began to close the small window. Merrick stuck his bare, paw-sized hand into the window, preventing it from completely shuttering, and said calmly, "I am the ground steward of Eshtagum." The young man chortled a laugh and pulled the window back open, looking Merrick up and down. "I've met the ground steward. He's half your size and twice your age," said the penury. "You're not him. Now be off before I set the dogs on you. I'm the new ground steward, and you have no dogs. I have business with Curate Barda, and I'm frozen through." "Open this door," said Merrick, tired of the young man's insolence. "How do you know we have no dogs?" asked the penury. "They'd be barking, or they'd be useless, in which case you would not have them," answered the ground steward with a hint of anger. "What happened to ground steward Raker?" asked the penury. "That is none of your concern. Now open the gate, or I shall have words with your curate," said Merrick softly, but with evident malice. "How do I know you're not some bandit come to slit our throats? They're all about these days," asked the young man. "Who is at the gate?" shouted a voice from within. The penury turned and replied, "A man claiming to be the ground steward." There was a moment of silence. Suddenly, a staff of ash or beech crossed the penury's face, and a knobbed top handle landed hard on his shoulder, accompanied by an angry shout, "That is the ground steward, you sod! Open the gate for him!" The sound of grunting could be heard as the penury lifted the heavy wooden drawbar that kept the gate closed. He pulled the doors inwards, squinting as a gust of wind followed. Standing just outside the arc of the doors was a man, not as tall as Merrick, but tall, dressed in black robes and a white cowl, the standard dress of a curate of the Order of the Homan. He wore a purple sash, indicating he had been in the order for 10 years or more. His face was wrinkled from a lifetime spent in the wind and sun. Merrick suspected that not all the wrinkles were from wind alone. Many a homan took to the drink more than they should, and by the looks of this one, he thought, other things were shriveling him up from the inside out. The man's hair was receding, and though it was still dark as midnight, the sides were flecked with grey. The eyes were quick and cunning. He would see more than he let on, and they would not betray his thoughts. The curate leaned on the staff he had struck the penury with the wind flowing his robes around him. The lad stood next to his master, rubbing his shoulder and averting his eyes from the ground steward. "Ground steward, welcome. I am Curate Barda," said the man, speaking loudly over the wind. "Let us get you and the horses out of the cursed latia." Merrick noted that both men stole a glance at the sacks hanging in a sheath off the front of his belt. The sacks was a long, single-bladed knife that was the preferred secondary weapon of most soldiers and a tool and primary weapon for most others. He figured that neither man had ever held a blade or been in a physical fight in their lives. The penury stepped forward and took the reins from the ground steward as the curate waved his arm to welcome him in. Merrick pulled his pack from the cart and followed Barda, who had turned on his heel and was heading towards the southern tower. The curate turned and looked over his shoulder to ensure Merrick followed him. The penury led the horses to the barn. As they walked, he turned again and, shouting to be heard, asked, "We were not told of the change in ground steward until recently. What happened to Master Reike?" Merrick purposely stopped. The curate sensed it and stopped as well, turning, leaning on his staff in the howling wind. Merrick met his gaze. He stood there silently for a moment. Barda could not read his body language. Merrick said simply, "He died." Barda tried to temper his reaction, but the involuntary swallow, the quick blink of the eyes, told Merrick all he needed to know. "Let us get out of this wind, shall we?" said Barda, spinning quickly and striding towards the door to his quarters. Merrick surveyed the orphanage as he walked through the courtyard. There were three low stone buildings set against the far wall. The wind quickly blew away the smoke rising from their chimneys across the courtyard. Opposite the buildings was a barn with a dovecote attached. Next to it was a combined workshop and a small oba, which meant roundhouse in the old tongue, a building used for religious ceremonies. The nomadic tribes of the eastern plains still used the round structure for everyday living. The Anates, the god-cursed people to the north, still lived in similar dwellings, though they were no longer nomadic. Some people of Estergom still retained this tradition for their religious ceremonies, but, as with burials in the dirt, the tradition was changing. In the cities, great stone temples, shaped like obas, were now built for the worship of the Valas. As he walked, two young boys scurried out of the barn, heading towards the low buildings. They stopped when they saw Merrick and only moved again when the penury yelled at them. The ground steward and curate entered the tower, and the noise of the wind that had plagued Merrick during his travels was mercifully muted. "It is fortunate you arrived when you did, Master Merrick. This windstorm will get worse as the night goes on." "The Latia are late this year," commented Merrick. "How did you know it was me outside the gate?" "I received your dove this morning," answered Barda. "The bird was sent out 15 moons ago. How could it have only arrived today?" asked the ground steward. "The Latia, as you said, were late. They say the goddess Mara brings the winter wind, Larda the spring. When they do, it is told, the goddesses will fly between Estergom and the Hurta Pass, and the noise they make, imperceptible to us, can be heard by the beast of the field and wood. Perhaps it confuses animals, enough for a dove or pigeon to lose its way," offered the curate. "Perhaps," agreed Merrick. "Was the seal broken?" "No, the canister was intact," answered Barda. They stood in a vestibule, the walls and ceiling cut from oak. Thick beams with runes and carvings reached upward in support. The ceiling was barely higher than Merrick's head. Against one wall sat an old bench with hooks for hanging cloaks and coats attached in the wall above. A spiral stairway encased in stone led upwards. "You may leave your cloak and pack here if you'd like," offered Barda. Merrick shook his head. "Thank you, but I will hold on to them. The cloak makes an excellent blanket, and the pack contains material for the ban." "Your belongings are safe here in Malmok," said Barda, holding his hands up in a customary sign of peace. "You misunderstood my meaning," lied Merrick, satisfied that Barda had clearly understood his meaning. "I am entrusted with the material in the pack by oath, and so it must remain within my sight or care." "Yes, yes, of course. As the ground steward of Estergom, the ban's purse, you would naturally be travelling with important documents, receipts, purchase orders, and even court orders?" said Barda with a nervous titter. Merrick did not miss that. The man's resolve was slowly breaking. He knew he was in some trouble. The ground steward smiled inwardly and let the man stew a bit in his own broth. "Where can I rest?" "The journey from Adany was long and hard," asked Merrick. "Ah, yes, forgive me. The road can be such a curse," said Barda. "The guest room is up the stairs." "Follow me. I'll make my way," replied Merrick. "Very well, it is not much. We do not often get overnight guests at Malmok. Linens have been laid out for you. I shall send someone when the evening meal is ready." "We shall dine in my chambers," said Barda. Merrick nodded and headed up the spiral stairs. They ended at a closed oak door with a round iron handle. He pushed on the door. It opened on creaking hinges. Beyond was a small stone room with a wooden floor. An old bed, not large enough for his length, was arranged with fresh sheets, pillows, and a heavy wool blanket. A wooden chest sat at the end of the bed. A brazier had been placed in the room, and a small fire was lit. A pile of wood was stacked nearby. The fire provided little warmth, but mercifully the wood was dry and did not give off much smoke. Merrick set his pack down on the bed, pulled the wooden chest next to the brazier, and sat on it, warming his hands and gathering his thoughts. He grimaced and rubbed his hip. The old wound ached after any long outing. His cloak would be welcome this evening as the room would be cold, though better than the alternative, sleeping on the hard earth in some hollow with the wind howling about him. A wave of exhaustion rolled over him, and he gave in. Walking to the bed and lying down, he pulled the cloak over himself and closed his eyes. He woke with a start. Everything was dark, and he had a momentary panic, unsure of where he was. A soft tapping focused his mind, and he remembered he was in the guest room at the orphanage of Malmok. The sound came again, accompanied by a muffled voice. "Master Merrick, the evening supper is prepared." Merrick sat up in the bed, and both he and it let out a groan. "Yes, yes, I'll be down in a bit," he said through a yawn. He stretched, rose, and reached into his pack and pulled a padlock from it. Opening the chest, he stuffed the pack into it and placed the lock on it. He jiggled it a few times, satisfied that it was secure, reassured himself that the key on the chain around his neck was still there, and made his way down to the vestibule. The penury, who had been at the gate, was waiting for him. He opened the inner door and said, "Curate Barda and Prioress Gusselin are waiting inside." The prioress was of the same age as Barda, skin as wrinkled though darker. One eye was blind. It sat grey and lifeless in its socket, as if someone had dimmed the light behind it. The other was a grey-green and stared at him intently. She was dressed in robes of black cloth with white trim. She sat with her hands crossed in front of her, the hands of someone used to manual labour. The table was set with roasted chicken, a pile of cooked potatoes, carrots and green beans. A bowl of hot broth pluming steam into the air, and a carafe of red wine beckoned to be emptied. Barda rose from his seat and raised his hands in a sign of welcome, touching his chest and opening his palms towards Merrick. "Welcome, Ground Steward. May I introduce Prioress Gusselin?" "The pleasure is mine, sister," said Merrick with a slight nod. He sat opposite the prioress and suddenly realized how famished he was. 4 days of dried meat and fruit was all he could bear. His mouth watered from the succulent smells wafting up off the table. As was the custom, he brought his own cutlery, a spoon made from cow horn, which he pulled from a pocket, and he drew his sacks from its sheath. As was also custom, he served himself first as a guest under their roof. Bowls and a ladle had been placed on the table. He poured himself a portion of the broth, and with his sacks cut off one of the chicken thighs. He took the carafe and filled a goblet with the wine. Out of politeness, and the fact that his bowl was filled, he left the vegetables for the others to have first. The curate and prioress helped themselves. There were no formalities, and the diners focused on their food with little conversation. When Merrick had finished his broth and chicken thigh and was pouring his third goblet of wine, the curate cleared his throat and said, "Your note said you were going to Adany first. What news from there?" Merrick looked up from the goblet he had raised to his lips, put it down, wiped his mouth on his sleeve, and simply said, "Plague." Gusselin gasped and said softly, "Istn protect us." Merrick looked at her and asked, "What makes you think Istn did not send it?" She narrowed her one good eye and replied, "The people of Adany are devout. Istn would not do such a thing to his followers." Merrick gulped his wine and shrugged. "The gods are indifferent to us." Gusselin, who was zealous in her devotion to the Valors, folded her hands, leaned forward against the table and said, Surely the grip comes every year. Even a few of the boys in the orphanage have the wet cough as we speak. It is not a plague sent by Istan or any other god, but a naturally occurring event. Merrick picked some chicken gristle from his teeth and said softly, "It is not the grip. There's no cough. It starts in the abdomen. People who survive go through a week or two of the shits with a fever, maybe cramps, and then are fine. The ones who get it worse start as the same. Then the pain worsens, as if a creature is gnawing its way out from your insides. The fever drenches them, and they see visions. In the end, their piss turns black. There's nothing one can do. They give the worst ones large amounts of Dwali to ease their pain. They call it the black water. And the worse ones?" asked the curate. "What do you mean?" asked Merrick. "What happens to them?" asked Bada. "They die," answered Merrick bluntly. "At what numbers?" asked Bada. "By my guess, 4 in 10, answered Merrick. "And of those who get sick, how many become the worst case?" asked Guslin. "No, you misunderstood. 4 in 10 who get sick die, all the worst cases die, and quickly the strongest last 5, maybe 6 nights, answered Merrick. "Those poor people, I will light some birch leaves and lamb's wool to beseech Mara to alleviate their suffering," said Guslin. Merrick hesitated. He was no priest. He had no love for the gods. As he remembered the dead, so many no longer stacked, just left in piles, waiting to be placed into the flames, he said, "Have a thought for the pious seers. So many have died. The funeral fires burn day and night, and the dead lie about in wait. Your brethren there must perform the passing ceremony for dozens at one time. A great kurgan has been dug, and the ashes are interred there. The black water takes old and young, rich and poor at will. The only privilege in Adani is life itself." The table was silent. Merrick broke it. "I noticed a graveyard off the upward path, and I saw no pyre altar in the yard, no kurgan. Are you not Hauman?" "We are, but the old ways are changing. Your soul goes on for judgment, whether encased in the ground or released through fire. There are some who would disagree with that. The beadle of Estagon would be one." "Yes, yes, the debate rages strongly on this point. Beadle Obus believes in the old ways, but this new thought comes from the temple at Bokord, by the sea. Many see it as the correct way to honour the dead now." Merrick drank some more wine and mused on this. Then he spoke philosophically, which was unlike him. Perhaps he needed to clear his head of the sights and sounds he had witnessed. Perhaps it was the wine. "A plague takes all the petty joys of our lives and dulls them. Distant memories we wonder if we will ever have again. It takes the everyday, mundane routines of our lives and makes them dangerous. Greeting a neighbour, a chance encounter in the market. One never knows who is sick. It is said to touch one with the illness is to get the illness yourself. Death hangs like a weight around the city and will not be lifted until the kurgan is closed and the roots of the new grass on top intertwine with those who lay beneath. These are dark times in Adani, and they will get worse. Life has become cheap, crime is rampant, and many will die not just from the plague, but of what the plague has done," he said matter-of-factly. He was an old soldier and had seen death in all its forms. It did not deter him, and he always felt speaking truth was best. "What is to be done to protect the rest of the Banat from this evil?" asked Bada with concern. "I have ordered the city placed in quarantine. No one enters or leaves," answered Merrick. "So many will die," said Bada softly. "Yes," said Merrick. "I am not indifferent to their suffering, but doing nothing would condemn the entire Banat. It is as when a wound turns to rot. Sometimes, to save the person, you cut a limb off. It is Adani's misfortune to be that limb." "Do you have the authority to do that?" asked the prioress. it is murky by law. Only the ban can quarantine a city, but since I speak for the ban in matters of commerce, I am given wide leeway to make decisions in the ban's name, explained Merrick. How will it be enforced? Asked the curate. I sent doves from Adany to the 10 nearby manors. They are each required to send at least 2 fawnies and to let no one enter or leave on pain of death, said Merrick. And food? Asked Gusselin. We will provide. Orders have been made for wheat and barley from as far as Erdene, answered Merrick. These are dark times, said Barda. Indeed, they are for all, which brings me to the reason for my visit, said Merrick, pouring himself another goblet of the wine. Reike, my predecessor, is dead, executed by order of the ban. It would seem he amassed a personal fortune off of coin the ban intended for other purchases. All the woodrunners save one were also executed as they assisted him. I've come to take 4 boys from here back to Estagon to replace them. Barda and Gusselin exchanged glances. Barda looked as if he wanted to say something. His mouth opened, but then quickly shut, and he turned away, gazing at the floor. He had wondered. For 12 moons, he had waited. No doves, no messages. A part of him had hoped. Hoped that Rake's absence was some bureaucratic blunder, that the silence meant nothing, that perhaps, fortune had smiled upon him. But fortune never smiled on him, did it? Merrick had come, and the way he said executed by order of the ban left no room for misinterpretation. Gusselin recovered and said, We are here to help. Ground steward, Barda nodded in agreement. I would expect nothing less, said Merrick, pouring himself another goblet of the wine, for you have been implicated as well. Barda swallowed and said with fear in his voice, Ground steward? There was nothing we could do. Riker forced us to be involved in his schemes. Stop your protest. He kept a ledger. Your role in all this is well known to all, including the ban. I would also say, by the condition of this sty, that the money the ban has been sending for upkeep and repair has found its way more often into a chest buried somewhere about these premises and not into local tradefolk, said Merrick dryly. How dare you, said Gusselin. How dare I, Wat Prioress, accuse you of that which is already proven, that you two are simple thieves hiding behind the facade of your religious order, that you steal the charity of the ban, meant to benefit youth who have nothing. I am the ground steward of Estagom. Know your place and watch your tongue, or I will have you dragged to the keep and have a visit with the Inquisitor, spat Merrick. Forgive her, ground steward, said Barda softly. We are at your mercy. You are lucky you are not, for there would be none. Raker gave you up. His ledger confirmed your guilt. If it was left to me, your head would rest on a pike on the castle walls next to his, said Merrick with controlled anger. But I would take your meaning to be that we will not be executed, said Barda with some hope. I thought there would be a benefit to your deaths. A public execution is always good for dissuading others from stealing from the ban. The ban felt executing you would displease the gods, so you live under my domain. You will now send me monthly reports, expenses, who did the work, when items purchased, a full accounting. It would go a long way to making your lives easier if the missing funds... Appeared, said Merrick, as he rose from the table. He wiped his mouth on his sleeve and added, I need 4 boys of 11 to 13 seasons. It is hard work, any younger, and they would not be able to do it. Any older, and I am here in a season or two replacing them as they go off to apprentice or become squires. Barda and Gusselin rose with him. We are thankful for the ban's mercy, said the curate. But the coin, we do not have it. Where did it go? Asked Merrick with a bemused look, as he expected a great fable to be told. For protection from bandits, they've threatened us, said they would burn the orphanage down, sell the boys on the southern border into slavery, or worse, pleaded Barda. Bandits, said Merrick with sarcasm. It is true, ground steward. They send a man each moon cycle to collect, said Gusselin excitedly. The curate speaks truth. What man? Asked Merrick. From where? I do not know, said Barda reluctantly, trying to warn Gusselin with his eyes. She wrung her hands, looking past Merrick towards the vestibule, and then she looked intently at him with her one good eye. He goes by the name of Ferenc. Barda's face went white. Merrick nodded and said, Thank you for the meal. He turned and walked out without another word. When he entered the vestibule, the penury was waiting, seated on the bench. Merrick looked at the novice and nodded, then carried his weary and slightly drunk body up the stairs. The penury entered the curate's chambers and began to clear the table. Barda looked at him and asked, Well, Mirko. He placed his pack in the chest, said the penury. And he locked it. He brought his own lock, said the boy apologetically. Barda sighed in disgust and turned to Gusselin. And what were you thinking? They send a man each moon cycle.
We told the truth, said Gusselin.
We told a half lie, corrected Barda. And a man like that, he nodded up at the ceiling. A half lie is as good as a full one, and enough excuse to take our heads. We had to make him believe us, retorted Gusselin. No, we did not, said Barda in exasperation. We needed to plant a seed. Bandits were enough. They roam the Adani plains, or maybe live deep in the Koza, or perhaps they are sir on a raid. But now, a man comes and collects every month. Now, there is something to look into, isn't there? But there's a story that he can believe now, said Gusselin with less confidence. Barda let out a long sigh. We were in Raker's ledger. Merrick knows our guilt. Do you think he will believe we simply turned over every piece of coin to some bandits? But he has a name, someone to search for, to keep him preoccupied, said the penury. Barda glared at him. Eavesdrop on me again, lad, and I will stuff you in a grave next to those orphan rats at the bottom of the hill. Yes, he has a name, one that will not even last a cursory search. Even if there is someone named Ferenc in Adani or Estegum, it would be obvious he is not one to run with bandits and thieves. And Merrick will keep digging, for he has a man to find now. They stood silently for a bit, then Gusselin asked, What are we to do then? We could run, said the penury. And how far would we get? An old man, a one-eyed old woman, and the village jester. Could you fight off a man-at-arms? Could we survive out on the plains in winter? No, we stay, we behave. I'll tell Merrick you meant Felushi. Raker always spoke of him as a rake and cutthroat. It will be more plausible, said Barda. Leave now. He'll have us up and about in the morn so he can pluck four sots from this place, scowled Barda. In the guest chamber, Merrick looked at the chest. The lock had been moved, as he suspected. There really was nothing of value in the pack. It was just a test to see how desperate the curate was. He would store this information in his back pocket for further use. Placing the sacks near the head of the bed for easy access, he pulled his cloak over himself and drifted off into sleep, dreaming of being a warrior again, in burnished armor and with comrades who were different but alike to him. They were chasing something in the darkness, something he loved and something he was concerned about. The dream changed. He was in Akka's kitchen, eating at his customary table and drinking his hidden ales. Outside, a storm raged and people lamented, but the food and drink were too good to rise up and see what the commotion was about. Then he went into the dreamless sleep of a tired warrior.